Welcome to JGL Law For You. JGL Law For You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law For You, we will be discussing a wide array of topics to help you navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Folks, we are back today with my partner, Lindsay Parvis. For over 20 years, Lindsay has focused on helping her clients navigate some of life's biggest challenges, divorce, custody, domestic violence, and financial matters like alimony, child support, and property division. Lindsay makes complex information and advice understandable and manageable, which is not easy to do in the family law world, by the way. Her services include attorney representation and advocacy, parenting coordination, and mediation. Lindsay, welcome back. I've said that a few times, but I am happy to have you because it's actually a topic I know a little bit about. So.
Thanks, David. I'm looking forward to the conversation. It's going to be a lively one, I'm sure.
Me too. So today we're focusing on the intersection between mental health and family law litigation, right?
Yeah, sure are, because it's something that comes up all the time. Because so many families and individual folks work with mental health providers, but it's not something that gets talked about a whole lot in the law and not something that there are a whole lot of trainings about.
Let's talk a little bit about it, I guess maybe from a client perspective, right? What does somebody need to be mindful of as they enter into domestic litigation when it comes to the involvement of mental health professionals?
Sure. Well, starting out, what they need to be thinking about is, first of all, are there already involved mental health professionals? And what's their role? And who are they working with? That's all important information to share with your lawyer so that your lawyer can have on their radar, okay, these are the existing mental health professionals, and we're going to get into this, but who has the therapeutic relationship with those folks? Or does it turn out that there's not a therapeutic relationship and it's not a privileged role?
And when you say privilege, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so privilege means the confidentiality that a client has with a mental health professional. Sometimes working with a mental health professional, you have that confidentiality, which I'm also going to use the word privilege for. Sometimes working with a mental health professional, there's not that confidentiality. And that's an important distinction to make.
And how do you know when there is confidentiality and when there isn't?
Well, generally speaking, there's not confidentiality when someone has been appointed by the court to do work, or maybe has been selected by the family to do work, but has a court order that is choosing them to do the work. That's a first question. Is this going to be confidential or not? Sometimes with group therapy, which means you have a group of individuals who are meeting with a mental health professional, but those individuals aren't related. They aren't really connected in any way other than maybe the topic of the group therapy. Well, group therapy is not privileged. There's not an expectation of privacy because everybody's kind of strangers to one another. They're not working necessarily on some common therapeutic goal. There might just be some general common topic. Those are some examples of when mental health professionals are involved and there's not privilege.
So I come to you and my spouse and I have been in marriage counseling for 15 years. And I'm concerned about some of the discussions that took place during the course of that marriage counseling and somehow could be used against me. Is that something where I can exert a privilege and make sure that that marriage counselor can't testify?
Yeah, so that starts to become, going back to what I was talking about, who are the mental health professionals who are involved? What has been their role and who are they working with? And marriage counseling is an example of having a couple who are doing therapy with a specific mental health provider, and that therapy is considered privileged and confidential. It's in the nature of family therapy, for example, that's also privileged. And this is an area where I think there can be a lot of confusion among professionals, but that's a different conversation. But yeah, it is privileged. And therefore, when you have multiple people participating in therapy together, everybody has confidentiality with the mental health professional. Everybody has to be on board and in agreement if that mental health professional is going to testify. If one person's not in agreement about it, then they get to shut that professional off from participating and testifying and their files being open as exhibits and used at trial.
Okay, so let's shift for a second to this, quote, mental health professional concept that we're tossing around. There's a lot of different types of, quote, professionals hanging out there who do, let's call it counseling, just from a layman's perspective. You've got divorce coaches. You've got people who get these online certificates and go to these trainings and so forth, but have no specific education beyond that. Are communications with those types of folks, are they likely to be privileged so that they can't be called to testify in the midst of whether it's a custody or a divorce matter or some other family matter?
You raise an interesting question, David. And to my mind, it starts with the idea that just because it's called therapy or counseling, for example, doesn't mean that it's privileged. Where you really start with, is this privileged, is with the licensure of the person who's doing the work, what type of work they're doing, and how the work they're doing lines up with the law. Because we have these parts of the law that talk about the privilege, and we have different laws depending upon the licensure of the provider. So that's always your starting point. What's the licensure and what's the work that they're doing as to whether or not it could be privileged? And then there's even a further looking at it, because the law about these different providers is not the same for all the providers. Some mental health providers have greater scope, bigger scope of confidentiality, and other mental health providers have a much narrower scope of confidentiality, this privilege. So you really actually have to take a look at it. And so this is why I'm talking about it, because oftentimes you've got so many families who are involved with mental health providers, and this is not something that I think a lot of clients know to have conversations with their lawyers about. And lawyers, if they haven't really studied up on this, like you, David, like I have, they don't know that they should be having these conversations with their clients and figuring out, is this information off limits and do we need to protect it? And what is our strategy if we're going to protect it? And what is our strategy if we're going to waive it and open the door on this confidential information?
Now, I want to ask you about the strategic side of things. Are there times in certain family cases, let's say in a custody matter, where one of the parties has been in treatment, in therapy for some period of time, whether it's a psychologist, psychiatrist, a licensed clinical social worker, whatever that licensed professional may be, that may be covered under this privilege umbrella, that the other side can try to force the privilege to be waived, force the mental health professional to testify? So I guess what I'm getting at, and let's talk about a custody case where there may be allegations of mental illness by one parent against another. And the parent to whom those allegations have been made has been in treatment for a long period of time. But that parent does not want to waive their privilege. The spouse, on the other hand, feels it's important for the court to hear what's been going on with their spouse over the last 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it is, and thinks that the therapy, the aspect of the therapy and what that spouse has been treated for is important in the court's determination of what happens with their child, what's in the best interest of their child. In that type of a circumstance, how, if at all, can an attorney for the spouse who's seeking to force the waiver of the privilege or force the testimony of that mental health professional. What, if anything, can that person do?
Trying to force it is not how the law is structured. What I mean by that is it's the client, the person who's seeing the therapist, who's the decision maker on whether or not they're going to waive the privilege, so open the door on that confidentiality. So another way to think about it, if you want to picture this in your mind, is that the client is a gatekeeper, and that therapeutic information, the file, the notes, it's all kept behind this gate and closed off. And the client is the one who has to decide whether they're going to open that gate or not. So that's one part of it. Another piece of this sort of puzzle is that not every single piece of information is privileged. It depends on the licensure of the provider. Licensed clinical social workers and social workers in general have an extremely broad privilege and confidentiality that basically everything's off limits. But there are other types of providers like psychiatrists, psychologists, licensed counselors, licensed professional counselors, and certain types of mental health nurses. I don't have the whole title memorized, but those folks, certain information is privileged. Not every single bit of information is confidential. Sometimes if a spouse is looking to a parent who is not the one working with the therapist and they want to try to bring in information about what's going on with the therapy, there's non-privileged information like the prescriptions that have been prescribed for the other parent or the other spouse. What has occurred in the waiting room or what's occurred outside of the going into the office, if there have been any sort of interactions or any sort of activities that occurred, or this is where it starts to get more complicated, if the client has signed a waiver at some point in time, an authorization for their partner to talk with and communicate directly with their mental health provider. Sometimes when the relationship is still intact, folks will do that. And that becomes an issue about, okay, well, that may open the door. Certainly some areas where the spouse can push. And then last but not least, there are these non-privileged, kind of circling back to what we talked about at the beginning, non-privileged ways of gathering information about someone's mental health. An example of that would be a psychological evaluation. So having someone appointed to do an evaluation of a party or a parent spouse and give their diagnosis and their opinions.
Yeah, so let me ask you about that part. People may or may not be aware in certain cases, courts order, sometimes people agree on custody evaluations, an independent mental health person looking into the family and trying to make some recommendations, do an investigation, make some findings and recommendations about what's in the best interest of, ultimately, what's in the best interest of the children. So in those circumstances, when the court either appoints an evaluator or people agree that an evaluator is to be appointed, can that evaluator speak to one of the spouse's therapists without there being a waiver of the privilege?
Generally, no. No, there has to be a waiver. I would say there is that sort of gray area of not all information is privileged. So what of that information might be shared with the evaluator? But by and large, unless there is a waiver, so the client is knowingly, with informed consent, signing off for the evaluator to speak with their counselor or therapist. Without that waiver, it's not going to happen.
Okay. And with the waiver, doesn't it open that therapist up to the lawyers themselves, not just the custody evaluator? So I say, okay, yeah, it's important. I want the evaluator to know what's been going on with me and what I've been talking about with my therapist and how we're working on and so forth. So yes, I'm going to waive that privilege. So the evaluator then goes and speaks with my therapist. But now, haven't I opened it up to my spouse's lawyer also to look into the underlying opinions that might have been in part formed by those interviews with my therapist?
Yeah, so this is one of those interesting areas of the law that is not super developed. This is where I could get into being a legal nerd, but I will spare people from that. Generally speaking, there's not a limited or selective waiver to be able to say, I am waiving my privilege for this one person in the custody case to talk with my therapist, but no one else gets access to that information. That's not an example of where there's some talk in our case law about limited or selective waiver. Limited or selective waiver is not something that I think is to be relied upon, number one. And then number two, it doesn't happen that way. So it really is going back to this picture of a gate. And if you're going to, as the client, open this gate for information to be shared, you're opening the gate for everyone. Though I will say from anecdotal experience, I also think there are some misunderstandings in the law. Sorry, among professionals and others who are involved about limited waiver. That's the real world experience and whether it matches up with the law.
So let me switch to the other side for just a second. And let's assume for the purposes of discussion that you're representing a client and there is that custody evaluation going on, or there's a custody case going on where, and the other spouse has made allegations of mental health issues, wants to talk to the therapist, and you've determined that it's not in your client's best interest to waive that privilege. Are you concerned at all in those circumstances about what conclusions a judge who's making a decision about what's in the child's best interest might draw? In other words, Mrs. Jones, you're the gatekeeper, but the gate's closed. Now, I, Judge Bullitt, would have liked to have heard some of that information, but now I don't know what that is. Is it possible that those judges might draw a conclusion that would be harmful to your client if you don't waive the privilege, either whether there's a evaluation or not?
There is one runs the risk, right? Like, what is it that the parent is keeping secret and keeping off limits? On the other hand, I think there's, going back to the practical experiences I've had, I think there's a lot of recognition among some judges that therapy and the therapeutic space is one to be respected and honored. And it's important for people to feel like they have a safe space. When I'm in the shoes of a lawyer and representing a client and we're not waiving privilege, we're also having discussions about other ways to demonstrate where they are from a mental health perspective so that it makes it harder for a judge to just see a big gaping hole in the evidence about how the client's doing. The other thing is just, and I'll leave off with this, custody evaluations, and that's a discussion for a whole other day, but custody evaluators are only supposed to give recommendations if they have all of the information that they need to be able to do so. So one does run the risk of, when not waiving privilege, keeping important information out of the hands of the evaluator that may make it so the evaluator can't make recommendations or can't make fully developed ones. And that's all part of the pros and cons that you have to think about on whether or not to waive privilege in those situations.
You know, it's interesting. You know, in criminal cases, obviously, anybody who watches television or watches any crime show knows that people, I take the fifth, the privilege against incriminating yourself. You don't have to testify in a criminal case whether you've been charged with something. And a jury is instructed in those situations that if a person does, in fact, take advantage of that privilege, it can't the jury's not permitted to draw a conclusion, a negative conclusion, against that particular defendant because the person has taken advantage of the privilege or exerted the privilege. Are there any laws of which you are aware, whether it's in Maryland or the District of Columbia or even elsewhere, that sort of mirror that? In other words, that judges are told that they cannot draw inferences as a result of a party apparent not waiving the mental health privilege.
Focusing on Maryland and not on other states, because one, I'm not licensed there and I don't know what their laws are. It's not the law, the state of the law in Maryland, that if someone says, I'm not waiving my therapeutic privilege, that then it can come back on them legally, the way you're talking about with this adverse inference. To use an example where in family law, someone is asked the question, did you commit adultery? Adultery is still a crime in Maryland. That's a whole other conversation to have. But it's a crime and someone can invoke their Fifth Amendment rights, right? And they can say, I'm not going to answer that based on my Fifth Amendment rights. In doing so, in this civil realm, family law or civil cases, not criminal cases, the judge is allowed to draw an adverse inference. And what that means in practical terms is the judge is allowed to come to the conclusion based on the person invoking their Fifth Amendment rights and other corroborating evidence being produced. You can't just draw an adverse inference in a vacuum. With other corroborating information being produced, they can come to the conclusion that, in fact, someone did commit adultery and then come to conclusions about what that looked like, right? And how impactful that was on the marriage, all without someone testifying about it. When we're talking about mental health privilege, it's not developed in the law that way. And really where it's come about, maybe this is getting a little law nerdy, but I had to remind myself of this because I wasn't practicing then. It was up until into the 70s, I think it was the late 70s, that judges could order litigants, so people who were in court cases, if they were seeing a mental health professional, judges were the ones who were deciding and could order that the mental health provider would testify or produce their file. Up until that time, the judges were the decision makers. Well, what has happened in the law is now the client, the person who's participating in the mental health services, they are the decision maker. And to my mind, that's way more how it should be.
And that was a law that was passed in Maryland by the legislature. I think I want to say it was before I started practicing, but in around the 1980-ish mark, give or take. And I know you do a lot of work in terms of looking at potential legislation in the state of Maryland. And I'm wondering, and we're going to end with this, what would you think about a statute that says a finder of fact, a judge, because we don't do jury trials in family cases in Maryland, a finder of fact cannot draw any conclusions in the event that a litigant decides not to waive his or her mental health privilege. That's not artfully said, but you know what I'm getting at. What would you think of a law like that?
Yeah, I think one that's interesting, and I also, thinking about it just right here and right now, I think that would be consistent with the change in the law. Granted, it happened many decades ago now. But this change that puts the decision making in the hands of the client, right? And that the whole idea that therapy is a safe place for people to do work on themselves, to process their experiences, to process challenges, and to learn and to grow. And if you're constantly trying to rip that open or weaponize that against people by drawing adverse inferences against them if they don't waive privilege, it really discourages people from seeking the supports that they need and benefit from.
All right. Well, Lindsay, we could talk and talk and talk about all of these things and all the things that sprout out from this stuff. Hopefully we'll have you back and get maybe dig some more into some of these sort of additional issues that you raised today. In the meantime, how can people get hold of you?
Well, they can reach me on my office number, which is 240-399-7900.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. Everybody out there, thanks for listening. We will see you next time on JGL Law for You.